Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Now, because of social media, everyone has a say and everyone has a say about what everybody else says. And implicit in that is a debate on free speech and what the limits should be. Andrew Doyle is a comedian and the person behind the super woke Titania McGrath Twitter account. And his position is pretty straightforward. If we can't agree on the restrictions on free speech, then there shouldn't be any. Andrew is the author of Free Speech and Why It Matters. And he joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
So why does free speech matter?
Because the freedom to speak is the baseline of all our liberties. So without it, you don't have any other freedoms. It's absolutely essential that we are able to innovate. There hasn't been throughout the history of humankind. There's never been innovation without freedom of expression. And it's very important in terms of education. The way in which we understand the world is a collaborative process, and it comes about through discourse. Once you start silencing certain elements of discourse because they are offensive at any given time, and let's not forget that ethical standards shift depending on time and culture, so that's a pretty important variable right there. If you're not able to do that, if people feel that they have to self-censor because there is a climate as the one we are currently experiencing where people don't feel that they can be completely open about what they think, then no progress is ever made. And most importantly, if we're really serious about defeating bad ideas, the best way is to hear them out and to challenge them and to ensure that they don't spread.
Is it always the best way? Has history borne that out, that bad ideas are always argued into extinction?
Yes.
Nazism.
Exactly. So there's a very good example. So Nazism has been in terminal decline in this country. It's very much...
Historically, though, Andrew, I mean, it wasn't argued to extinction. We had to kill millions of people to make it go away.
Well, actually, that didn't make it go away, did it? I mean, the point is that the vestiges of that ideology still exist, and that's why we need to stand up against them. And actually, yes, of course, there was the necessary action of the war to defeat an instance, an egregious and overwhelming instance of the manifestation of that ideology. But the ideology itself only went away because, it hasn't completely gone away, let me just emphasize, but it only declined to the extent that it did because we have reason and we have the ability to discuss. It is based on a fundamentally irrational principle that certain groups of people have a supremacy over others. This is something that isn't well sustained in debate and collapses fairly quickly.
I hope I wasn't misrepresenting you. Your contention is that there should be no limits on free speech, no matter how horrific or egregious the thing is a person might be saying.
The question you have to ask isn't whether or not do you support the person saying these horrific things. The question is much bigger than that individual. And the question is, what do we believe in terms of the principle of free speech itself? If we're willing to sacrifice this absolutely most foundational of principles in any liberal democracy, because there are a few individuals who will abuse that freedom to say horrific things, then what you're effectively doing is granting those people, the people that you despise, an awful lot of power. It means that you're willing to surrender your own principles because of them. I'm not going to give them that power. They absolutely don't deserve that. And so therefore, I think whenever you hear someone saying these dreadful things, don't think, okay, would I prefer it if they were silenced? Because most of the time we would. When I hear people espousing hateful views, my instinct is to say, I wish they'd shut up and go away. But I also know that if we empower the state to do just that, then we relinquish a freedom that we all share. And in fact, it's self-destructive because it damages our own freedoms more than the people that we instinctively want to silence.
Does that extend to lies or mistruths?
Of course, yeah. I mean, we all have the freedom to lie. That's one of our freedoms. I don't know, you know, we should try not to. I'm all for, you know, encouraging honesty. And I think actually dishonesty is really self-destructive psychologically. I think it's one of the worst things you can do to yourself. But that's why we socialize children so that they don't lie, although, of course, children instinctively lie all the time. But yeah, absolutely. So people should have the right to be wrong about things, you know. And I think an example that you, I suppose what you're alluding to there is this phenomenon of fake news, which is, there's nothing new about that. You know, that's always been the case, that people have peddled untruths. People say things about me that are factually untrue all the time online, but they're entitled to be wrong. The best way to counter that is to point out where they are wrong. And, you know, whenever we have those situations where truth and falsehood grapple, you know, truth wins.
Well, That's a very optimistic view. And I was thinking more of in the political sphere, because once you've, you know, there's an old political adage, once you're explaining, you're losing. And as soon as an accusation is made, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how false it is. That whiff of that initial falsehood still lingers in the air, can still have an influence on people, can have an influence on voters. And they mightn't all have got the news that actually what you heard or what you read was untrue.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, are you talking about the concept of libel laws there? Because, I mean, of course...
I'm thinking of, like, you know, the EU, we send the EU £350 million a week, and we're going to spend it now on the National Health Service.
Okay, well, that's a very specific example. The bus that you're referring, the sign on the side of the bus, it didn't actually say what you've just said, but
it clearly implied it. Let's fund the NHS.
It did absolutely. I'm not denying that. But what I would say to that is, I mean, Brexit's a very good example. You know, I have never seen the public more engaged politically in any topic ever in my lifetime. You know, with the mass debates we had debates on TV, we had one in Wembley Arena, for goodness sake. You know, the level of interest, people were having conversations at the pub, at the bus stop. You know, this idea that people didn't know what they were voting for, that is the fake news. You know, people were talking so much about this stuff. And if you think that anyone voted to leave because of something that was written on a bus, then you need to check your head, because I couldn't find you a single person who would fall into that category.
Right, so the people who voted for Brexit didn't actually believe that.
For a start, it wasn't a statement of fact. It was a statement of potential policy. But the people who voted for Brexit were voting on a much, much bigger principle and much broader than simply funding the NHS. And we know that because, again, you know, we can have recourse to truth and facts. We have the Ashcroft polls in the wake of the Brexit referendum made it perfectly clear why people voted the way they did. The number one reason why people voted to leave the EU was based on the principle that laws that govern this country should be made within this country. Now, we can pretend that that's not the case all we like, but the data bears it out. So
I'm not disputing any of that, Andrew. I suppose the point is, and that was one example, and you talked at length about Brexit there, but politicians of all stripes and all countries do this all the time. They misrepresent each other's positions and the truth gets muddied all the time.
I totally agree, and I wish they wouldn't. And, you know, I think there is, you know, it's a political tactic that is underhand. Thankfully, I have faith in humanity and people can see through those tactics. And of course, the best way to counter such tactics is through exposing them. And that's why the best politicians are able to expose the lies and the misrepresentations of others. And I think we need to have a little bit more faith in humanity and the electorate more generally, to be able to weigh up their options, to hear people out, to listen to debates, and then to come to a conclusion as to who is telling the truth.
So would it also be the case, Andrew, that you would believe that words really don't have that much of a real world effect? In the sense that minorities often say, if you say hateful things about us, it has a real world effect.
Again, we don't have to speculate on this because the data is in on that. There's a common belief now, and this is one of the problems that free speech advocates face, is that there's a common faith-based view that mass media, entertainment, film, cinema, books, whatever you like, that representation and the way that things are described linguistically actually change the behavior of the public, you know, almost have a kind of corrupting influence on the public. This, by the way, was, of course, the key argument of Mary Whitehouse's Clean Up TV campaign back in the 1960s and her subsequent campaigns through the 70s and 80s. So this is a very old reactionary idea that thankfully has been completely discredited by the research. There's been six decades into media effects research, and there is no correlation between mass media consumption and public behavior. So we can put that to rest. But the what's disturbing about that is just the ease with which it is assumed. And this is why you get this category of hate speech. So, for instance, in the UK, police record non-crime hate incidents. They've recorded in a five-year period 120,000 non-crime hate incidents. And their defence for this is quite specific. The reason why the College of Policing include this in their training guidelines is they claim that non-crime, in other words, non-criminal language can lead to violent crime. And the recorded incidents of any non-crime hate incidents leading to violent crime are precisely zero. It's not true. So we really need to challenge this stuff, and we really need to have recourse to the truth, not just to these wild speculations that people want to hold on to.
So if things that are said in the mass media don't have an effect on the public, then nothing has an effect on the public. Then the truth that will out doesn't have an effect on the public either.
It's just all noise. That's not what I'm saying at all, because people are open to persuasion. Well, they better be, because if they've got an open mind, they should be. And they're able to change their mind. They're able to listen to different points of view. These things can't... I'm not saying they don't have an effect and discussion and debate doesn't have an effect. Quite the reverse. What I'm challenging there is this view that the public act mechanically on cues based on the type of language that they hear from politicians, the commentariat and the media, because that is not true.
Well, I don't know if they'd if it would necessarily always be presented as that, other than there's a kind of an eroding effect where perhaps if people are angry or discontented about something that can be gently nudged towards, say, a minority to blame.
It's presented explicitly in that way. I mean, when we had the argument in Parliament about Boris Johnson using the phrase the surrender bill, or using phrases such as betrayal, and many people on the other side of the aisle were quick to say that he was directly inciting violence through the use of military metaphor. And some of the evidence that they provided, I remember Jess Phillips reading from a horrible letter that she'd received from some awful individual who quoted Boris Johnson's words. But of course, that is not evidence of causality. That is evidence that the person in question is able to quote. It's not the same thing. And it's really important that we understand that difference.
So if minorities say that they feel that it changes the temperature for them when certain things are said, do you disregard that?
Not at all. I mean, you can raise the temperature. I think the example of Donald Trump is a very good example where, you know, he was very ill-equipped to deal with heightened tension, and politicians can certainly raise the temperature. But largely, this isn't due to a causal effect between words and the way that people behave. What that does is it kind of gives a stamp of approval on people who are already predisposed to behave in a certain way. So, for instance, it didn't surprise me in the least that hate crime increased after the Brexit vote, because you'd had 6 months of the media telling the public that Brexit was all about race, and that basically anyone who voted for Brexit was a racist. So, of course, the tiny minority of authentic racists in the country suddenly feel emboldened by that. So that's true. That can happen. But that's not the same thing as a direct effects model of influence and causality.
So you wouldn't think that Trump, that say, and the United States is quite divided this way, it seems, that so many people have veered into various conspiracy theories, which Donald Trump has been happy to stoke. But you don't think that he had an effect on giving those conspiracy theories some degree of credulity or credibility, I should say.
I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that the people who succumb to those conspiracy theories are typically those who are predisposed to do so anyway, or want to do so, or who have thought about it and fallen for it. It's too simplistic to blame this on one particular authority figure. That doesn't really make sense. I think what you've got to think about is, what is the alternative? You know, political language has always been robust, has always used robust, colourful metaphors, particularly when it comes to violence. They use metaphors such as to go out and fight, or strength, or on the battlefield,
sure,
or that kind of thing. So is what you're suggesting, that what we need to do is actually censor political speech, to set parameters on political speech, just in case some people are influenced to do bad things on that basis? I mean, is that really a workable scenario that you're describing?
I honestly don't know, Andrew, and I don't know where the line should be. I often kind of struggle with it, but I also don't believe that a complete free market for ideas and any hateful thing whatsoever is somehow a self-correcting mechanism. That's like saying that capitalism is going to do everybody good all the time.
So the way to frame it really is a question of, which would you prefer? You know, we cannot live in a perfect society. We're dealing with human beings here. So there will always be people who hate other people for whatever reason. So it comes down to the question, do you want to enact state censorship or any form of censorship in order to prevent a tiny minority of bad people from proselytizing and trying to spread their awful message? Or do you want to empower the state to decide what is acceptable for people to say and think? Because if you know anything about history, you'll probably decide on the former of those two options.
Also, this is, I suppose, complicated by because so much of this of the free speech debate now has been polarized into people who are, you know, generally in the Tatiana McGrath camp, and even though she's an extreme example of that, but that and the other camp, so that everybody's suspicious of each other's motives anyway.
Yeah, and that's a real problem. I think you've hit it there. That, I mean, I think that's the major problem that we face in today's political discourse is this mistrust, this kind of this assumption that you have any access, this kind of telepathic access to what your opponent or detractor is thinking and secretly thinking. You know, most of the arguments on Twitter, I'd say 99% of the arguments on Twitter, are people who simply don't understand the other person's point of view or are intuiting a motive that simply is not there. And most of this kind of behavior is coming from the very people you describe, that what we call the culture warriors, who are those people on the extreme right or the extreme left of society who make an awful lot of noise on social media, but are by no way the majority of people. I think we need to go back to the basics of argumentation. It comes down to education. Kids need to understand that once you start guessing what you think someone else believes, once you start throwing insults instead of debate, you've lost the argument and you shouldn't really be participating in it because you're just undermining your own point.
Yeah, somebody just texted in to say, you just want to hear what you want to hear, Sean, and not what he's actually saying. Typical woke news talk. There's an example. Yesterday I was called news talk was called the voice of the far right by somebody on Twitter. Well, so I suppose if we're both things at once, maybe we're doing some good there. Andrew, thanks very much for speaking with us today. That was Andrew Doyle there, a comedian, the author of Free Speech and Why It Matters, and you should check out Tatiana McGrath because actually is really funny.
Moncrief on News Talk,
brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.